drivers, train operators, bus operators, commuter rail operators, you know, delivery workers. I said supermarket as well. Postal workers, UPS, FedEx, all of them. We're going to clap right now for all of those essential workers, and we're going to do it right about now. Here we go. Even though, for some reason, federal government does not consider themselves being the ones of the legislative type, do not consider themselves as essential workers and putting their health on the line, those individuals that do the work and barely get paid any type of decent salary are the ones that are putting their lives on the line. And we thank you for all of your work and all of your efforts to make sure that we have some kind of normalcy here. Now, stay tuned for We Only Want the World with Sansara Taylor. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Good evening. My name is Sansara Taylor, and I'm glad to be with you live for We Only Want the World, live here both on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City and WPFW-FM in the Washington, D.C. area, 89.3. Shout out to our sister station, both part of the Pacifica Network. So here on We Only Want the World, we always put humanity first, never America first, and we look at the whole world, how it is and how it could be radically changed through an actual revolution. I am a writer for RevCom.us, the website, and an advocate for the new communism forged by Bob Avakian. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Sansara Taylor. And if you tweet at me during the show, I'll bring your question or your comment into the discussion on air. As we usually do a little bit later in the hour, I'm going to open up the phone lines and invite you into the conversation because we have such a great show. I'm so excited about the show we have planned for today. I'm speaking to you, and you are receiving this information, on the 50-year anniversary of a truly momentous time in U.S. history. And a whole series of events, starting May 4th, just over a week ago, there were four students at Kent State in Ohio who were gunned down, massacred by National Guards. These were students involved in protests against the Vietnam War, a wave of protests that happened across the country on campuses in response to Nixon bombing Cambodia. So this was an escalation of the war. This was an escalation of protests. And then there was massive repression. So, and four students were shot dead. Just a few days later, there was an uprising in Augusta, Georgia, in response to police brutality and torture and murder of a young man there, a youth there, and civil rights workers, black liberation fighters, and students and others got involved in a struggle there, a rebellion in Augusta, Georgia, just a few days after the Kent State massacre. Six black people were killed in Augusta, Georgia, in the midst of that by the police. And then just a few days later, after that, coming on Thursday this week, will be the 50th year anniversary of a protest at Jackson State University in Mississippi, where the Mississippi Highway Patrolmen were sent in and opened fire and massacred two more students there and killed, wounded 10 others. So this was a moment of massive repression, but also massive uprising. And I think that it's very important that there are moments when there are crimes committed against the people by oppressive powers that have the effect of crushing people's spirits and cowing them and intimidating them into silence. But in fact, this had the opposite effect. These were times that were very filled with hope and daring among many who were demanding and putting a lot on the line for a different world, for a different way things could be. So we're going to take a look at what went down. We're going to draw the lessons about the nature of this country and its real history that's often buried and covered over. We're going to draw the lessons of the defiance and the hope and how things that seem all sewn up can rip open and change, sometimes very rapidly. And we're going to look at that and reflect on it from today as well. So I'm very happy to have as two guests this week with me on the air, two people who were on the ground at different junctures in this upsurge with a grounds-eyed perspective, firsthand perspective that were part of and being shaped by those events, who can look back on them with us. One who was up in Ohio on the campuses and one who was down in the deep South. So I'll introduce them in just a moment and we'll get into this. But I do want to, just as at the outset, I know you know this, you've been listening, you've heard it many times today probably, but we're in the midst of a fund drive at both WPFW and WBAI. And I want you, as you listen, to think about what difference it makes to have this programming. Anytime, but especially now, when so many people are sheltering at home, when you need real information, when you need to hear things you don't get in the mainstream media, and this program in particular, We Only Want the World, where we take on board the whole world and how it can be radically changed. Think about what this means to you. And a little bit later, after we get into the program, I'm going to ask you if you are able to make a contribution to each of these stations, whichever one you listen to, and if you can, to do it in the name of this program, We Only Want the World. So I'll give those numbers out in a little bit. But first, to set the stage, I want to play just a little bit of audio. I have two clips I'm going to share with you throughout this hour. One is from the actual audio. It's rare audio. It was donated to or shared with the YouTube program that I'm a part of, the Revolution Nothing Less show on youtube.com/TheRevComs YouTube channel. I think you know about this. We upload every Wednesday. I encourage you, if you haven't, to subscribe to the channel and to catch our new episode coming up this Thursday. But last Thursday, we had a special piece of audio and visual shared with us by the filmmaker David Zeiger. He made the film Sir No Sir. He's done a lot of different work that's very important. And he dug up this footage that shows the actual the protests on the campus, the response, and has the audio from the police radio of what went down on Jackson State. So I want to play that to set the stage. And then you'll hear my voice come in where in the footage that David Zeiger gave us. This is words on screen, but I read it over so that you can hear what's printed there about how this spread. And then I'll come back at the other end. We'll bring our first guest on and we'll dive into this. So let's play the first clip.
41 to 20. Go ahead, 41. Man, they're right in front of the Student Union building, that new Student Union building right on Lane Street. Maybe about 50 of them. Tempo. Call that security guard out there, Jackson State, and see if they can't scare them niggas.
They're running wild and hollering, and there's just looks like a congregation, these people running back and forth across the street.
We have a perimeter set up there, but we are being rocked. Should we go ahead and dash me these dormitories? Just hold off.
But our people are going in there now to move the people out of the street.
Next, 536 campuses shut down. Over 4 million students went on strike across the country. 30 ROTC buildings were burnt to the ground. National Guard troops sent to 21 campuses in 16 states. 11 students were stabbed by National Guard in New Mexico. And the Army 82nd Division Airborne was sent in to protect the White House from students. All this in the summer of 1970.
He met with university presidents. They were all scared to death. Feel that this now includes the non-radical students. And agreed that the whole university community is now politicized. And there's no way to turn it off. The general feeling is that without Kent State, it would not have been so bad. But that even without Cambodia, there were a lot of campuses ready to blow.
Okay, so that's a little audio that puts you back in 1970. The first that you heard was the police radio of during the shooting and the massacre of black students at Jackson State. And then following that was a sense of how this took off, student protest across the country, and a commission by the White House on student unrest that made a very important observation that this was not just the radical students. This became the mainstream of the students across the country in opposition to the war and to the powers and the authorities. So with that, I want to introduce our first guest. Lenny Wolf is a revolutionary and a follower of Bob Avakian. He's a fighter for real revolution based on the new communism that's been developed by Bob Avakian. And back in 1970, Lenny was a radical student on campus involved in taking up the defense of Bobby Seale, a leader in the Black Panther Party who was being railroaded. I think we'll talk a little bit about that. He'll share a little bit about that. And he was very impacted by and played a role in the protests that followed the murder at Kent State. So, Lenny Wolf, I want to welcome you to We Only Want the World.
Hi.
I'm so happy that you are with us.
Yeah, glad to be here. Yeah, I'm eager to talk. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, so you were there. I wanted you to take us back to 1970. What was affecting you in the world and what was going on in your life? Let's just start right on the ground.
Okay. Well, I think just to kind of, let's say to set the stage, there were two huge things that were going on that young people in particular, but all generations had to wrap their mind around in the 1960s in the United States in particular, but things that also reverberated around the world. And one was, as you started with, the war in Vietnam. And this had, several million Indochinese were slaughtered by the U.S. in that war. And what was an effort to crush what was a struggle for national liberation and independence. And as that war went on, many, many people began to not just see that it was unjust, not just to oppose it, but to viscerally oppose it. And this began to include veterans of that war, soldiers in that war. And so this was something that was constantly in the background. And going into Kent State, there had been a period where the president at the time, Nixon, had been doing what he called de-escalation. And this was having an effect, which turned out to be a temporary effect, on the student movement that had arisen against the war. And it was somewhat, I don't want to say dying down, but it had entered sort of a period of intense calm after what had been a big upsurge in late 1969, almost 500,000 or 750,000 of people protesting at the White House. At the same time, you had the black liberation struggle that had also become in the minds of millions and millions of people, beginning with black people and people who had a sense of justice, but then spreading much, much further to all sections of the population who could see there was real right on the side of black people. And in particular, there was a brutal campaign of repression that had been launched against the Black Panther Party. And this had included a trial coming off the Democratic Convention in which the chairman of the Black Panther Party had been bound and gagged in the courtroom and then finally removed for the trial simply for demanding the right to defend himself. And this was on national TV every night, and it had a tremendous, at a time when people watched national TV network news, it had a tremendous impact on people's thinking. A few weeks later, on December 4th, another 50th anniversary of a few months ago, a leader of the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton, in Chicago, had been murdered in his bed by a squad of police. And this was all building up to a situation where, at the very weekend when Nixon was, as you pointed out, invading, he didn't just bomb Cambodia. They had been bombing Cambodia. He invaded Cambodia with ground troops at a time when he had been promising to de-escalate. That same weekend was right before the opening of a trial in which Bobby Seale was facing the electric chair, again, the chairman of the Black Panther Party at that time. So these two huge struggles that were definitely moving the soul of America were both, they were both bound up in that weekend leading into Kent State.
Well, I think that's helpful setting the stage. Could you maybe tell a little bit, you were involved in the struggle at this point. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself at that time and how this was impacting on you. How did it feel? How did it make you think? How did this unfold for you as well?
I had been somebody who had gotten into the struggle at different times, gotten discouraged at different times, but I was profoundly alienated from the system. And when Fred Hampton was shot down in his bed, I felt I really can't just stand aside as a profoundly alienated person anymore. I had to do something. I had to jump into this. I couldn't let this go down. And I wasn't alone in that. There were a number of people I know and people who I don't know, I'm sure, who had similar reactions to that killing, that massacre in the Panther House. And I went back to school to become, you know, as I hoped at the time, I felt if I became a teacher, I could do something to at least try to make the conditions better. And at the same time, I got myself reinvolved. I began to get reinvolved in radical politics. And I was, you could say I wasn't fully both feet in at that point. But I was, you know, I was still becoming more and more gravitating towards that thing. And I had become a very active student on my campus in opposing the war. And as you pointed out earlier, supporting the Black Panther Party. And this was, you know, so I was one of the activists at that point.
And then you decided to go, my understanding is you decided to go to the trial of Bobby Seale out in New Haven.
Oh, yeah, there was a whole slogan that came out from the Black Panther Party, come see about Bobby. And we took that up and we came and saw about him. And it was very interesting because to go back to what you said at the beginning, you could tell there was a different temper emerging amongst people. I went to a meeting. I was part of a meeting that helped plan it. And there were broader students at the meeting than you normally see, like the theater department. The theater department at my school did not go to meetings. But a couple of theater department people came, and I heard them talking afterwards, and they were weighing the possibility of real danger in New Haven, which is where the demonstration was, because that's where the trial was. It was at Yale University. The National Guard had been stationed at Yale to prevent outbreaks, quote unquote, and there had been all kinds of rumor mongering going on of what was going to happen and this was going to happen. And these students were, one student said to the other, well, if we go to New Haven, you know, we might get shot by the National Guard. And the other student said, well, I guess we better go then. And they both went, you know, because people were it wasn't that people were looking for a fight or anything like that necessarily, but people were not going to be deterred amongst, there was a section of people who are not going to be deterred by the normal threats that the ruling class uses to bring down on people. And this, as you said earlier, led into, this was the weekend right before Kent State. It was the weekend, I think it was on the, we were driving all night to get to Yale. And we heard on the radio that Nixon had launched a secret invasion of Cambodia, and this had come to light, sent U.S. troops across the border, which was a violation also of a congressional resolution, I might add, which also inflamed people because it was an illegitimate, even by the rules of their system, it was an illegitimate invasion. And all this fed into a situation that was increasingly politically combustible, if I can use that word.
My understanding is there were several thousand people who came out to that protest for Bobby in New Haven. Is that correct?
At least, yeah. Yeah, there was quite a few students who came from around the country to be at that protest.
So then just a few days later, so Bobby Seale is on trial, facing the electric chair, the leader of the Black Panther Party. You hear on the radio, Nixon has invaded Cambodia. And you come back, and my understanding is there was a big step up in protest on the campuses. That's
well,
what
yeah,
Kent
Nixon
State was about. But I want to kind of step forward from there. So the Kent State, there was protests against Cambodia. The Panthers and the mood of that was in the air. When you heard that the National Guard had come in and shot students, I mean, I still find it shocking. I look at the photos; it's stunning. And a moment ago, you were saying people kind of, maybe we'll get shot if we go out there. But that wasn't defining how they were calculating what they would do. And yet, when these students got shot, that must have been a shock. That must have been a jolt. Maybe you could talk some about that.
Yeah, I remember. One thing is, I should say that when we were at that Panther demonstration, you had students from all over the country who heard about this invasion and said, we've got to launch a massive student strike against this invasion. So that was the intent. And then I remember very precisely where I was when I heard that four students had been killed at Kent State. And I was with a black friend of mine who was also politically active. And he turned to me and he said, man, they're shooting white students now. This is off the hook. And, we had been planning for a meeting that night, and I said, well, we better get a room, that'll hold, maybe a couple of hundred people, because normally your normal meetings, even at the height of things, were 20 or 25 people. And then if something was really big happened, you expected 50, 80 people maybe. But, I thought, wow, this is really big. So we got this room, and a half hour before, people began streaming in. And it was really heavy, and so the room just got totally filled to the brim, so we had to get another room. We had to go to the college cafeteria. There were several thousand people, students from all these campuses. People from the surrounding communities had come, old people, as we thought they were then. They were probably in their 30s, 40s, 50s. Were coming, there was just this massive refusal to take this, a refusal to be deterred in the face of this violent repression that had been launched. These students had nothing who were shot. And after the guard shot them, there were even students at Kent who said, go ahead, shoot me. You know, people were, and then, you know, cooler heads prevailed and said, let's not rush the guard. Let's not do that now. They're, you know, that's not what needs to happen. But what did happen and what did need to happen and what did happen was some of what you described, that people, I think there were over 4 million students eventually went on strike, didn't just go on strike, went into the streets in all these college towns. The National Guard was sent. I remember University of Maryland, all these big state universities, they had to send in the National Guard. It was a tremendous massive student. A strike doesn't capture what was really a political revolt of a sort amongst the students at that time. They were very, people were not having it.
In your sense, why do you think it was that people responded with more outpouring and more outrage as opposed to, I could very easily see students being shot down, putting a chill and scaring people back. So why do you think it went the one way and not the other?
I think that, that's a big question. I think there had been a certain tempering of people over time. This was not, it's true, my black friend said to me that now they're killing white students. They had killed a white student, not a student, but a white community person, you know, a youth in Berkeley the year before at People's Park. 2 years earlier, they had killed three black students peacefully trying to integrate a bowling alley in Orangeburg, South Carolina. There was a sense, people were making sacrifices, and there was a sense that, there was a sense of a moral challenge to the rest of the country from those who had been making sacrifices, and a sense that there was a brighter future that could be had, that needed to be had, that made that worthwhile. You'll see in the film you describe when they shoot these students at Jackson State, which was several days after Kent. I believe it was May 18th that that happened.
14th, I believe, on Thursday this week. Yeah.
Yeah, Thursday this week. If you see the film that that Dave Zeiger lent you, you know, if people could see that, they would see that there were students then who just would not be deterred, who after that really horrific shooting that you have the soundtrack of, were out there, you know, demanding that the bullet holes not be cleaned up, and preventing the maintenance people from cleaning up the bullet holes because as they say in the footage that goes with the Dave Zeiger clip, people need to see this. People need to see what happened. Somebody was killed here. So there was a sense that, there was a sense of right on our side. There was a sense of a better future is possible, even if people had a very, all kinds of different understanding of what that would mean and what was involved in that. And there was a moral clearness. You know, we had a slogan at that point that we would chant at demonstrations, one side right, one side wrong, victory to the Viet Cong, because you had to make a determination who was right and who was wrong. And you had to, in particular, in an imperialist country, a country that is that rules people all over the world, you know, dominates whole nations all over the world, you had to decide which side were you standing on? Were you going to stand with those who were demanding your acquiescence in the oppression of millions and indeed billions of people? Or were you going to stand against that? And that was, you know, there had been, it didn't come out of nowhere. People had been, if you turned the clock back to 1960 and you had said to people in 1960, here's my prediction out of what's happening here in 1960. In 1970, you're going to have everything you just described about what did happen at Kent State. All that's going to happen. People are going to be profoundly alienated from the system. All these different things that even just on the Kent State thing, people would have thought you were crazy because they couldn't see the source of it, beneath the surface. Today, you can look back. I think it's a much longer show than we have time for today. But you can look back and you can see the cracks that were underneath the surface. You can see things, the fissures through which this kind of protest, this kind of rebellion, this kind of hunger for a different world was going to burst through and find expression.
Well, I think that's really important because, you know, speaking as somebody who wasn't born till quite a while after this, I learned about the 60s, and I think even more for younger people, people younger than myself don't even know what I knew about it. But I learned of it, it was all the high tide. It was all the rebellion. It was all, and the idea that it came out of the 50s, that it came out of something that seemed completely locked down and repressed. But as you're describing, there were cracks and fissures. I think there's a lot we need to, lessons we need to draw from that. If you are, I just want to take a moment and say, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to We Only Want the World with Sansara Taylor on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. I am talking with Lenny Wolf about the 50-year anniversary of the Kent State Massacre, the Jackson State Massacre. And right now I want to bring in my second guest because we're going to talk about something that happened in between these two events, which was a police killing, a rebellion, more repression and more rebellion down in Augusta, Georgia. I want to invite on Hank Brown, who grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, was a member of SCLC when he was 11 or 12 years old. By the time he was 15, he had run away from home, gone to Atlanta, and hooked up very shortly afterwards with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and got involved in the struggle in that way. Today, he's a member of the Revolution Club in Chicago. And Hank Brown, welcome to We Only Want the World.
Thanks for having me, Sansara.
I'm so glad that you're here with us. So first, I want to ask you to just set the stage for yourself as well. Before, I mean, you can go straight to Augusta if you want, but if you want to just talk a little bit about how did you come into the struggle? You came in through the civil rights movement and then the Black liberation struggle. It was a different path, but these things were all influencing each other. So why don't you take us down in the South and your involvement, and then we'll go to Augusta.
All right. I'll do a little bit of that. And part of it is if you grew up in Birmingham during the time I grew up, being a part of the movement, you was almost born into it. You know, by the time I turned age, there was a lot of protests already going on around civil rights there. And so my pastor, and I know it says the SCLC in the thing, but it was actually the NAACP, Reverend Welcher. My pastor was head of that. And he, you know, we went out. He started getting us to go out and register people to vote. So that's how I actually began getting involved in that. But even before then, you know, if you were in, when I was in elementary school, people were going out, there was strikes, schools were being turned out. If you were in school on a certain day, people were going to come and turn it out. So you got politicalized kind of early, and it all seemed quite normal at that point. And I think the big turnaround for me was when I actually hooked up with SNCC, and it was a kind of chance meeting. I had ran away from home, and down the street from where I lived was the H.R.F. Brown Center. And that's how I got introduced to SNCC and became a part of that. And this was during the time when the civil rights movement was making a transition from civil rights to Black liberation. And this is this, you know, and again, this is, you know, growing up in the South, if you go from Alabama to Georgia, you haven't went far. You had, what's the guy named? Lester Maddox in Georgia and George Wallace in Alabama, two stone races. And this is at the time I joined SNCC, this was, what was happening in the South. you had stone cold segregation. And segregationists who was trying to, you know, keep that going. And then there was a struggle to actually break away from all of that. And I thought one of the things that Lenny was pointing to that I thought was really important, that these things did intersect on one another. And even the I remember the reason we went to Augusta was to set up a coffee house in order to recruit black TIs. And part of this was the recognition of all the upheaval that was going on in services and stuff. But also there was a certain idea that they had developed skills and stuff, and it was important for them to be a part of this movement. So a lot of that actually did intersect. And again, there was...
Let me just, Hank, when you say, just so that everybody is with us in this conversation, when you say there was a targeting from SNCC of the GIs, partly because of the unrest in the military among GIs turning against the war, black GIs especially, but more broadly than that. But also, you said they had some experience in training. A lot of people might miss what you're getting at by that. And I think there's an assumption. I'll just put it on the table. There's an assumption, and it's bred, and it's popularized that the way the history gets taught, that all the struggle in the civil rights movement was nonviolent struggle. So maybe if I'm misreading you, let me know. But if I'm not, maybe we should make sure everybody is not missing it too.
Well, that is an assumption, and it's not true. And part of the reason they were being identified and targeted is they actually had been trained by the government in the use of military tactics and stuff. It was important that. We felt important that people, they were a part of this, and they brought certain skills that can aid in the struggle. And at this point, it wasn't about overcoming through protest. This, at this point, we had become revolutionary nationalists. And so there was a conscious thing on our part to actually make sure that we had people with certain trainings. I'm sorry.
Look, could I just break in? It was important. There was a sense that there was terrible, terrible unjust repression. I just mentioned Fred Hampton murdered in his bed. And, it was important that people do have the right to self-defense. And in addition to the fact that GIs come from a sector of society that would be certainly be part of any serious revolution when the time for that revolution became right, when there were millions and millions of people who were willing to put everything on the line.
I think it's very important what you're saying. And just in that light, you talk about the counter repression. One of the things that during the same year, Rep Brown, who was the head of SNCC at that time, trial was taking place in Maryland, and two SNCC members were killed in a car bombing during that same period. This happened earlier in the 70s. So there, I was talking to someone earlier, and this whole time there was so much going on and happening so rapidly. It was hard to get the sequences together and all of these things. But one of the things I do remember in relationship to this building up to the rebellion that took place in Augusta was there was, again, you have to situate yourself in the South in the 60s. And there was a lot of repression that was going on and a whole move to actually beat down people and keep them in their place and stuff. And there was different things that was happening in the city before the murder. There was a beating of a student at Payne College. There was another shooting that took place. And this stuff became intolerable for people. I mean, people, it, you know, when the torture and murder of this young youth happened, everything just kind of bust open. And, you know, if you think about Augusta, I don't know whether or not people know about stuff in the South. Augusta is a small, or at least at that time, a very small town. And in one sense, you can call it a sleepy town. It was more known for the Masters golf tournament, James Lindstrom, James Brown, and Fort Gordon was there. But these things built up, and people actually resisted. And there was this back and forth that Lenny talks about in relationship to that. There were student activists there. There were people who were revolutionary-minded, who were striving to be part of the Panthers and other groupings. So this thing of what was going broadly in society was also germinating in Augusta during the same time.
Well, I want to take a moment and ask everybody who's listening to make a contribution to enable this kind of programming. In this show in particular, we only want the world to keep coming to you, to keep broadcasting on WPFW, on WBAI. We're going to continue this interview, but I just want to intervene for just a moment because we are in a fund drive and we are at a time when a lot of people are hurting financially because of the pandemic, because of the unemployment, for many reasons. So if you are in a position where you can support these radio stations, it would make an enormous difference. If you can support this program, it would make an enormous difference. Donations are down overall, and everybody who can should step up and contribute and join the community that is making sure that we can continue to broadcast. It's more important than ever. So I want to give out the numbers, and then we'll go back to the interview. At WPFW, if you're listening in Washington, D.C. or in the area, you can go to the website, WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Or you can call 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. If you are listening in New York City or New Jersey or in the area or anywhere in the world online at WBAI.org, please become a buddy of the station and do it in the name of We Only Want the World. You can go to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. Or you can call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Become a friend of this program and help us keep coming to you every week that we can. Support us during this fund drive. It makes an enormous difference. So, Hank, I'm going to come back to you. I'm talking to Hank Brown, out of Chicago, who was part of the civil rights movement, SNCC, and the Black Liberation Struggle, is now a revolutionary communist and a member of the Revolution Club. I'm also have on the line Lenny Wolf, who is a follower of Bob Avakian and a leader in the National Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour, as well as many other things. We're looking back on the 50-year anniversary of the Kent State Massacre, the Jackson State Massacre, the rebellion in Augusta, Georgia. All of this happened within the span of 10 or 15 days, 50 years ago right now. Maybe, Hank, we have about 10 more minutes, maybe 9 more minutes altogether. So I want to ask you to speak just a little bit about the uprising in Augusta. Anything else you want to draw from that? And then I think we should pull back the lens and get overall reflections looking back. What are the lessons to draw from this period? But if there's more you want to take us into the experience in Augusta, I think that would be worth taking a few minutes on.
I'm really trying to contemplate on this. The experience in Augusta wasn't unlike other experience I've had coming up in the South. What was different in maybe in one South, not so much from Birmingham in one sense, where there was protests and fighting against the dogs and stuff like that. But what was different in this sense was that there was a determination on people's part not to accept this, you know. And even in the face of the National Guards, I mean, they actually did bring in the National Guard to try to suppress this. People found ways to actually continue to go out and manifest that anger in the face of all of that. And while it didn't last any more than 2 days, it was very powerful, and it reflected a broader sentiment out in society as a whole and stuff. So I that would be my last reflections on.
Okay, you know, I will say to everybody listening, it was part of what was so interesting to me in talking to you, Hank, before this interview was when I asked you about Augusta. You were down there, but you were also saying, "Oh yeah, these are your ability to pinpoint the explicit uprising that it happened a few days after Kent, that it happened a few days before Jackson State, that it happened. It was all in the air." And it was interesting to me that these events were impacting each other, but they also weren't, they were of a larger whole is what I drew from that. So I think, you know, they were different times, and it's very different now. And a lot of people can see the conspicuous difference, but I want to go back to what Lenny said earlier about, if you look at 1960, there were cracks, there were fissures that, out of which the full uprisings of the 60s and 1970 emerged. And I know that is a whole show. It would take a whole show to explore. But I think there's importance to not seeing things, even if they're quiet on the surface, as locked down permanently. So, Lenny, I guess the last thing I'd like to ask you is, what lessons do you think we should draw from those times?
Well, I'll tell you, let me start with the lesson I drew, which was, I think I said earlier in the interview, first of all, I want to say hello to my comrade Hank, who's on the line, and recommend that everybody look up and read his interview at revcom.us from about 5 or 6 years ago about his whole history, which does give you an inkling of what it was like in the South during that period on the real. But I think, just to go back to what I said earlier, I had gone back to school. I was thinking of, I would be a teacher. I was getting more drawn into the radical movement. The experience of Kent State and the huge upheaval in society that resulted, and the deeper reflection I was forced into, actually was very instrumental in putting both my feet on the side of, we need a revolution. What was decisive in that, though, was I began to try to figure out how that would be made. I looked into, I began trying to read about the Chinese Revolution a little more seriously, and I came across a pamphlet that was put out by the Revolutionary Union, the Bay Area Revolutionary Union at the time, called Red Papers, which was being led by Bob Avakian. And that had a very big influence on me in letting me see there was a possibility that you could see a way you could do this. You could see a method that you could analyze society, and you could see a way through to actually make a revolution. There was, if we had had a vanguard at that time that was rooting itself in a scientific method, there's no telling. You can't, you know, it would be fun to write a counterfactual novel, you know, science fiction, those kinds of counterfactuals, where people actually did try to make a revolution, but you couldn't have done it. What became clear to me at the time, and is even more clear in retrospect, you couldn't have done it without a vanguard that had a strategy, that had a method of understanding reality, that had a leadership that could do this. We've got that now. We've got Bob Avakian. who's brought forward, who's gone forward from that period. And has developed, further developed communism as a science beyond what it had been, and as a strategy, you know, strategic approach to revolution and to winning in the largest sense, to getting all the way through, to not just having a revolution turned back, as has been the bitter experience thus far in society too often. And in fact, now there are no revolutionary countries, but societies. But the but that was what I draw from it. What could have been? It's not to wax nostalgic. It's to draw the lessons of that period. I do want, if I have 1 minute,
you have really 30 want, seconds. Go for it.
Okay, I want to really implore your readers to read a piece that Bob Avakian did. Bob Avakian responds to Mark Rudd on the lessons of the 1960s and the need for an actual revolution. If you want an understanding of what happened in that period, what lessons to draw, where it went and where it could go, I really, really want to urge you to go to revcom.us. This is right on the landing page. Again, Bob Avakian responds to Mark Rudd on the lessons of the 1960s and the need for an actual revolution. And, that's what I would say.
Yeah, I would really echo that. It fits with the theme of the show, and it fits well beyond the conversation we are having now. There are real lessons to draw, and it's an incredible piece. So I would echo that. I want to thank you, Lenny Wolf, for coming on We Only Want the World. It's been my pleasure. Hank Brown, thanks for being with us as well. I want to echo Lenny's invitation to everybody to also go read the interview with Hank Brown that shares a lot more of his experience in the struggle in the South, coming up at revcom.us. And I want to close out by thanking the revolutionary rock band Outer National for the theme song to this show. I want to thank Reggie Johnson for engineering in New York City and Sierra Shine in D.C., I want to thank you for spending the hour with me. If you missed any portion of this show, you can find it on the archives at WBAI.org. Please share it with your friends. One last time, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Sansara Taylor. And remember, the problem is not human nature. It is the nature of the system. And through an actual revolution, a better world is possible. So until next week, we only want the world.
Challenge them to do what we do. Cook, clean, make slaves. Who feeds whom? Dirty, pretty things. Who are you? The ones you don't see. The fact of your truth. The ones you don't see. The ones you don't see. Que tenemos nada. Que queremos todo el mundo. Que tenemos nada. Que queremos todo el mundo. Que tenemos nada. Que queremos todo el mundo. Que tenemos nada.
This is Lydia Brazan, Interim Executive Director of the Pacifica Foundation. First and foremost, I want to thank our listener membership for participating in the Pacifica Bylaws Amendment Vote and Referendum. Many of you are not aware of the results, and so I'm here to share those with you. 65.2% voted no, and 34.8% voted yes. There are more detailed information on your local station website, as well as on pacifica.org. We also may have one to two more opportunities to vote for amending various portions of the bylaws this year. Thank you again for your continued support of the Pacifica Foundation and all of five stations. Thank you.
The U.S. prison system incarcerates approximately 2.5 million people. the highest number of any industrialized nation, while prisons remain the fastest growing industry in the country.
And people trapped in the justice system are particularly vulnerable to the spread of the coronavirus.
All my people up in Ray Brown. All my people up in Spafford. All my people in the group home.
To On the Count, WBAI's Prison and Criminal Justice Report, Tuesday evenings at 9 p.m., as well as on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. That's right here on listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Coronavirus health crisis is being politicized. Hear legendary progressive Noam Chomsky on the politics of the pandemic on the next Alternative Radio. That's Alternative Radio, heard Saturdays at 7 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM New York and streaming live at WBAI.org.
New York City, 2020 is a huge opportunity to make our voice heard. This year, we have the power to decide our city's future, not just for the next 4 years, but for the next 10 by getting counted in the census. The census is about power, money, and respect for our communities. If our city is undercounted, we risk being underrepresented, especially our communities of color. In 2010, only 62% of New Yorkers responded to the census, with the lowest response rates in our black and brown communities. In 2020, I'm going to tell you something. We can let this happen again. If you want to stand up to the status quo and the five people in power who wants to silence us, start by getting counted in the census. The census is safe, easy for everyone. And remember, the citizenship question is off the census. No matter what anybody tells you, immigrants with or without papers count too. Mi gente presente. Go to my2020census.gov now and fill out 10 simple questions to get counted.
Amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo issued this executive order.
All people in public must have a mask or nose covering, mouth and nose covering, and they must wear it in a situation where you cannot or are not maintaining social distancing.
Governor Cuomo on continuing to stop the spread of the coronavirus, and WBAI in the beginning of its spring fund drive to raise money for this listener-sponsored station to keep it going. We've created face masks with our own logo and a message that reads, "Keep Free Speech Radio Alive." You can get a face mask in white or black by donating $35. You become a listener sponsor, a member of WBAI for a full year, and you can choose the face mask in white or black. WBAI has created these face masks for you, and as a way to keep this radio station afloat, $35 contribution, 516-620-3602. Say you want a WBAI face mask in white or black. It has a saying that reads, "Keep Free Speech Radio Alive." You'd be helping us to keep WBAI and Free Speech Radio alive. 516-620-3602, or go to give2wbai.org and select the WBAI logo face mask in white or black. $35. You're a member of WBAI for a full year, and you're supporting this radio station. You're helping to keep our essential workers working, and you're helping WBAI pay the bills in the beginning of our fund drive, our May fund drive. We know how difficult it is, how hard it is for many people. If you can afford it, please become a member of WBAI for $35 a year and select the face mask as a gift to you. Thank you so much.
Hey, Harry, old buddy, old pal. Old friend.
So I want you to be my buddy.
Why can't we be friends?
You've got a friend.
Friend. Good.
Friend.
friends or buddies, as we like to refer to you as here at WBAI. Either way, we invite you to join us and become a member of this fine radio station. We want to partner with you, but we want to do it in the least imposing and most painless way possible. Here's the deal. It's called the Buddy Pledge. You give us your support for 12 months, and we give you access to the most eclectic music, as well as the best and thought-provoking news, talk, and community affairs. Sound good? See it in your heart to pledge a minimum of $10 per month. Each payment will automatically be deducted from your credit or bank statement, so there's no reminders needed. Just join us for a one-year membership and go online at www.give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org, and be part of our vibrant community. WBAI New York.
You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. My name is